The next case is 96-1596, State of Ohio Trail of Miami Student versus Miami University.
Because our needs will be met even if the confidentiality interests of the students. And by being...
Sir, even if those confidentiality is forgotten under the law.
So by being cooperative, you're lending credence to the stand that the university takes.
Your Honor, I think if you look at the history of how this matter came to this court...
You're saying, well, it's not black, but it's gray. Why don't you just hold your position and say it's all white and you have no authority whatsoever to do anything to those records. We're entitled to them.
Your Honor, I think we are being unnecessarily generous to the university in terms of the concession that the Your Honor suggests we've made. But again, the request we've made here as a matter of law, requested a writ of mandamus, is simply consistent with the posture my clients have taken throughout this proceeding, to be cooperative with the university to the extent that they can. We found, however, that the university, in effect, gave us no response.
So what you're saying, in essence, is that even though we're entitled to all the records, we only want a portion of the records, and that you should be given only what you asked for.
Well, what we've asked for, correct from the beginning, were records which would allow database of information to be compiled. That did not require the personally identifiable information which the university says that we were asking for. However, we also have said that if these records cannot be redacted in such a way, then we would request the entirety of the records. That was the clear scope of our request, both then and both now before this court.
So both parties, you now concede there's personal, that if they took out personally identifiable information, that would still, there's some way that your request could still be fulfilled. So where, and I had a hard time finding it in the brief, where do you part ways with the redacting that was done by the university? Because you do concede that they should redact certain items. What exactly is it that you think was, as a category, was redacted that you cannot live with?
Your Honor, first let me state categorically that we do not concede that they should or that they must redact any information.
Your brief doesn't stick with that, but go ahead.
No. Again, what we have said is that if the information can be redacted, that will satisfy your needs, university, to redact it. However, if the redactions will make the information being requested unintelligible or meaningless, then there should be no redactions. That's been the nature of our request.
Go to the category.
Now, the categories of information that we requested that we did not get were the locations of incidents, the dates of incidents, the gender, and possibly the age of the people involved. Most importantly, we wanted to know the dates of hearings and the outcome of hearings. All of that information, and I mean all of that information, was redacted. The information we were provided were nothing but black marks, which rendered the documents that were provided to us virtually meaningless, certainly unintelligible.
You don't disagree that, as the university argues, that if that information was given to your client, that someone could easily match up the police records with the incident reports that the police have with that information that would be given them and figure out who was that was the subject of the disciplinary action. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chief Justice, I could not disagree with the university more than I would have.
Okay, you argued that in your brief. I'd like to hear your argument here on that point.
It's simply this. First of all, if it's possible to match up information that the university was provided to us from the University Disciplinary Board with criminal records, then what legitimate reason is there for confidentiality? Because the confidentiality is gone by reason of the availability of the criminal records. That only demonstrates, Your Honor, this, that the records in question are law enforcement records. They are not disciplinary records. Law enforcement records are records which are not prohibited from disclosure by FERPA. So that defeats their argument right there.
I read that argument in your brief. I have a problem with that. I have a problem with understanding why the university records, even though they relate to an incident that was a criminal incident, perhaps some of them, not all of them certainly, but probably not criminal yet to have a woman in your room, but maybe it's against policy of the university. But the point is that the university can have discipline records that are records of discipline proceedings that are not criminal. You make an argument, you make a strong argument that that they are criminal because there's a sanction and it looks criminal in nature, but that's not what we usually refer to as criminal. Is that a disciplinary proceeding by a university that happens to order a sanction on a student?
Your Honor, first, a couple of points. The first one is whether or not a record relates to a criminal incident does not make or break the argument. Berkman draws a clear distinction between law enforcement records and disciplinary records. And the distinction, I think, is based on the fact that disciplinary records pertain primarily, if not essentially, if not only, to internal rules of conduct, whereas law enforcement records relate to safety and security at the institution. That's the clear distinction. Now, if we look at the university's own rules governing the University Disciplinary Board, we will see that that University Disciplinary Board has jurisdiction over criminal matters, civil matters, matters on campus, matters off campus, and they can sanction students by, among other things, financial fines, $100, $200. They can take away your ability to be a student. They can kick you out of the school. That's tantamount to law enforcement.
But
the fact that they ultimately result in discipline does not answer the
question. I have such a problem with your argument, the whole argument about safety risks and tying it to this disciplinary board, when, as the respondent points out, that, and we have copies of summaries that are prepared, they're mandated by federal law, and a special pamphlet that isn't even mandated. All the business about safety seems to me a bit of a stretch, where it's all available from the actual law enforcement. I read your argument. I thought it just really didn't even seem to be done with a straight face.
That's simply untrue, Your Honor. For this reason, first, the records that are required by federal law to be kept are just statistics. That's number one. Number two,
isn't that what you're after? Statistics?
No, we're after information from the University Disciplinary Board, from which a database can be compiled. But number two, federal law only requires that certain acts be reported, only be reported if they happen on campus, and all you know is that there was a number of these types of incidents. That's the only requirement under federal law. What it doesn't tell us is what's happening off campus involving students, which become the subject matter of university disciplinary board proceedings. That's nowhere to be.
I mean, how does that relate to safety?
I would like to know if I have a child going to Miami University or any other public institution, how matters. Are there
how
serious
discipline is handled?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Are there serious risks on campus? And it's not even a requirement that we use it to know what security risks are on campus. We use this information for public records for any law purpose. But we want to know, among other things, whether the university is consistently applying its own internal rules and policies. And there is no criminal record, no law enforcement record of the university disciplinary board proceedings, which would give us that information. In other words, we have presented a situation where we see where the university does not follow its own rules. And the only way that information would become known.
And if you switch back into whether they follow their own rules, which is no doubt an interesting subject, but it doesn't, again, stick to relating to safety, it seems.
Well, again, I take serious disagreement with that, Your Honor, because whether or not university is consistently and fairly and effectively applying discipline on campus has a lot to do with whether or not that campus or that institution is a safe one.
But there are two sides to this issue, and the whole purpose of the public records law is to let the public know what's happening.
Absolutely.
And here you've got a situation, like we've seen on other campuses, where my guess is you're trying to show what kind of problems there might be with crime and other activities on that campus, so that I, as a parent, I'm going to send my child there, or more so, students who are there, to stay away from certain areas.
Correct.
But that's just the theory. The law is more interesting to me. How do you get to the point, how does anybody get to the point that these are anything but incident reports?
Well, these are more than incident reports, the information we requested, because what we're looking for, among other things, is the results of the University Disciplinary Board proceedings. We want to know, is the university doing anything about misconduct on campus? We want to know.
Yeah, okay, but they start out as an incident report.
Yes. Certain incidents.
Routine incident reports under the case law is clearly discovery. Is clearly you have a right to that under the case law.
Correct.
All right. So what flows from the incident report is the discipline. Now, where in the public record statute is it or is it not that university information is exempt?
It's not. There's absolutely no exemption there.
And if you're
just like the rich to develop such an exemption, that is their prerogative to do, but they've apparently chosen not to do so. And I might offer this as well.
Now, before you do that, the other thing with Mike's last question is about FERPA, because really, what we're talking about there is educational records. I mean, if they aren't educational records, does the federal law apply at all?
We don't believe
as a threshold question.
We don't believe FERPA constitutes a prohibition, but if it does constitute a prohibition, and education records come into the umbrella, these are not education records for a couple of reasons. First, they're law enforcement records, by FERPA's own definition. And secondly, we're asking for information that's stripped of personally identifiable information. And finally, the university runs no risk of violating FERPA for several reasons, not the least of which is that FERPA contemplates this kind of conflict. It says to the university, if you have a conflict, you shall go to the compliance office and you shall seek a resolution to that dispute. But if a court such as this orders materials to be provided, that's a safe haven by FERPA's own rules. There is no reasonable possibility of prosecuting a violation of FERPA.
I've found two different statements in your brief on disciplinary records, whether they're education records or not. They seem to be inconsistent. On page 10, this is a statement, disciplinary records are education records under FERPA. And then on page 9, accordingly, these documents are not education records for the purposes of FERPA. It's your contention that they are hard or not?
Disciplinary records, according to FERPA, are education records. Law enforcement records are
right,
not
clearly
education
not.
Records.
Right.
The records you're requesting are law enforcement records.
Yep, I'll give you a little time for rebuttal. Mr. Draper.
Good morning, may I please report? Mr. Meslow. The position of the respondent is quite clearly that FERPA most certainly applies. It is a prohibition. Justice Douglas has the question about whether the Public Records Act of Ohio contains any exemption or exception for these disciplinary records. The answer is clearly yes, because there is the exception to the Public Records Act that matters that are prohibited by state or federal law are not discoverable under the Public Records Act.
So therefore, according to our case law, you have to fit it under an exception.
Right.
And your exception that you argue in the conclusion of your brief is solely FERPA.
FERPA is a prohibition that works this way, Your Honor.
But that, yeah, I understand.
That law's been on the books, federal law for over 20 years, that says that the Department of Education shall hold the funding from any university that establishes a plan or policy of violating these confidentiality regulations. The regulations pertain to education records of any student.
Right, sir, I understand.
Right.
Tell me how an incident report of a criminal attack or a violation of the law is an educational record.
These are not incident reports. These are complaints that are taken to the Office of Judicial Affairs by a student or anyone else who has a complaint against another student.
Okay, let's accept that. How is that an educational record as opposed to their how they've done physics or statistics or something?
Well, you can't confuse education records with academic records. Academic records are the courses, results, the tests, the grades. Those are included in education records, but education records, as defined by FERPA, are any record pertaining to a student. That would include the disciplinary records of that student. The statute itself, of course, has the Public Code of Federal Regulations that give definition to the statute. And the CFR, if I could take a moment to walk through this law enforcement agency or unit, this dichotomy that's been created by the respondents, I'd like to do that.
That's fine, but you've done that in your brief, and I've read it all, and I've got one more question that to give you a fair shot at me, because I was prepared to issue a writ in this case. And the reason I did is because, Mr. Draper, I tie this together with the case of Hennen versus Toledo, where we ordered the internal affairs records of police departments released as public records. And we did because what happens is internal affairs, between bringing the officers in, having a hearing on whatever it might be, let's assume a rape while they're on the job, and some of that happened, disciplining the officer, and it never gets over to the police department for a charge. And then those records are all secret. Here, you're seeking to shroud all of that in secrecy, and the public has no ability to know whether or not it's being handled fairly, including the professor who had to quit because he was denied the access.
That's an added anecdote, Your Honor. The professor that decides doesn't like what happened to a matter that he heard, so he quits. There are other members of that board that have not quit. That board has been functioning for years. I would submit, Your Honor, that the distinction with the Toledo case is a couple instances. Number one, there is an expectation of privacy here given to everyone who takes a report to the use of their procedures. It's in the handbook that all matters that are brought to it are going to be handled confidentially. It's interesting that the anecdote referred to by the relators in their brief about the young woman who tried to take a complaint to the D-board, remember what they said in the reply brief? The reason she did that was to keep it private. Now, that expectation of privacy has been recognized by this court last year in other cases, that even a verbal assurance to somebody, if you give me information as part of my police investigation, then, and I tell you I'll keep it confidential, then this court has recognized.
But there's a specific exception in 149.43 for that.
Right.
Specific exception.
There's an exception to the federal law that prohibits the release of these.
And what you're telling me is we put it in the handbook, or the Columbus Police Department now decides to put it in their handbook that any information that comes with regard to any officer will be held to be confidential, then they can overrule the case law and the statute.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the rules of this disciplinary system, it's the internal disciplinary system, to confuse this with law enforcement, it's totally erroneous.
Okay.
This is handling student behavioral misconduct on campus. It has nothing to do with whether they can be taken down the street to the municipal court or the county police court and tried separately. There's no double jeopardy that attaches to what happens here. It is strictly an internal disciplinary process.
Which you also have police, you have a university police force.
We have a separate.
And you keep records of
sanctions. Department of Public Safety, that is the law enforcement unit. This is where the relators get totally confused in their arguments and their briefs. They try to squeeze the definition of ubiquity into a law enforcement unit, not giving due recognition of the fact that the campus has a law enforcement unit. And all the records of that law enforcement unit are handled like any other police department in the state. Now, when a matter goes from the police department or the law enforcement unit to the UDB, the board, the records that are transferred, of course, they keep the original records, but if a copy is sent to the board, it becomes part of the student's file, the student being accused of the misconduct. That, under FERPA, becomes part of that student's education record, so that the board has no right to be turning over those records to when you ask for them.
By transferring those records to the board, then you're making something that is discoverable not.
No, it's still discoverable in the police department.
No. You just said that if the discoverable record from the police department, right, gets transferred to the board records, they then become non-discoverable under FERPA.
In the hands of the disciplinary board.
Well,
that's where the request was made.
Then that is a system in which you make discoverable records non-discoverable. Transfer them to the board.
What you're saying, you could discover
you
them.
Go back to the police department.
Right.
The police report. It's there. It hasn't changed its identity in the hands of the police. But the UD, and you got to remember, we're dealing with administrative personnel that get a request to turn over records of students. Now, the records contain not only disciplinary proceedings, but the financial records of the parents, the transcripts of grades of the student, everything that pertains to that student's conduct and activity on the campus is in that file. the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act was specifically passed to protect the rights of the families and the students from having these records turned over publicly, unless there's a consent given by the student to do so.
I'm trying to better understand this process. It's a student or staff member that brings a complaint to this is the complaint informed of the outcome of that complaint?
Yes. There's an exception to purpose that the victim, for example, of any crime is one of those persons who's entitled to the information as a result of the process. There are two exceptions to purpose for the type of victim. One is for the victim. The other is if there is a true security issue.
But I assume not all of these, you keep referring to crime, not all of these here are about crimes.
Some are not. I mean, there will be a violation of both.
The complainant is included
in the process
and knows the outcome when that's...
And justify at the hearing.
Okay, but are they informed of the outcome is
my question. That's my understanding they are. They are a victim of the act. Now, if they're a complainant that says, I saw something happen that I don't like, I can't represent the court that they find out the results of that particular proceeding. But if you're a victim of what's happened and it's happened to you, then yes, you are in the loop of information as to what's happened here.
Okay,
now, you would be in the public prosecution then.
You've also, on this police business or crime business, focused on some stuff the campus cops learn. Is this, say a student commits a serious crime, armed robbery or rape or something, it's in some other venue and is convicted. Is this board where, is there an automatic expulsion or, if something of that nature happens, or does it have to go to this board to...
If there's a conviction, it can be anticipated on that exposure.
So this board doesn't get filed?
They can or cannot. Every one of them suffers a complaint filed on that board. The incident that they talk about in the later's brief has to do with someone who took a matter to the public prosecutor and the grand jury returned she then allowed to take it to the deep board. It was frustrated in the process and didn't work the way she would have liked to. If that man had been arrested, which he was not, if he'd been arrested with a crime by public authorities, then there's a separate public hearing that takes place under 1290, I think it is. It's a separate code that governs that type of hearing. Yeah, if he'd been convicted, then that, of course, would go on his student record, and that would be considered as student misconduct reviewed by the appropriate authority. And his tenure at school would be evaluated as to whether he should be suspended or not.
Mr. Okay,
yes.
I want to get back to the personally identifiable information, and that's a key issue here, because I think at the last council report that we're later concedes that he is asking for documents stripped of the personally identifiable information. And that seems to be where the real issue gets to here, is that the university redacted much more than the names and the social security number of students on the theory that this giving other information allows this to be easily traceable. Where in the, you know, that that's a leap that I'm having some trouble with. How is that shown here by the respondent? Are we to accept that as a matter of judicial notice that this is traceable? And most particularly, can you address the level of sanction? That does not, some of the things that you've redacted, arguably the date and the contextual information, maybe is easily traceable, and you'll address that, but the sanction imposed doesn't seem to be such a tracer.
So I fail to see how the relator can say that we did not give them information about the sanction imposed, because the records that they have, the ones five or whatever happened to them. And in fact, in the 67 cell records of the UDB proceedings that you have, there were only one or two instances in all of those cases where the student being accused was found not responsible. And the sanctions there, what's missing are the dates. We did redact the dates because of the, what we consider to be the easily identifiable tracing of information. Now, why did we choose to redact more than just name and social security number, which is your question?
I think we know why you chose to, but how can you prove to this court as a burden in the mandamus action that these are easily traceable, that these items permit a trace?
In the record, combined with the record we have, you have the statements of the university officials that they were concerned that as they came out the dates and the location of an incident, that someone could then go to the university police department or the Oxford City Police Department and reverse engineer the identity of the individual. They were concerned about that because as they read the definition of personally identifiable information, which is what they're being governed by. They don't want to lose $40 million in federal funds by violating FERPA by establishing improper policy. It says name, address, social security number, student number, a list of personal characteristics that would make the student's identity easily traceable, or other information that would make the student's identity easily traceable. Now that's very broad. I can see that. And I think you, any one of us, could sit with the same record and go about the task of redacting, maybe come up with a slightly different looking document. But what we'd be trying to do is redact all those things that if we looked at them, knowing the campus community and the environment, and this is a campus of 16,000 in a small community where things are more widely known than they might be here in the city of Columbus, dealing with Ohio State University, for example. You go through and you know that names and addresses certainly are identifiable. The location of the incident would happen in such and such a hall and such a date. That immediately triggers some identification of what's going on. And so the redaction process was to try to protect the names and identities of the witnesses, the complaining party, and the accused. The names of the people hearing the matter were not redacted.
See, now, FERPA isn't that broad, is it, Mr. Draper? To protect the privacy of witnesses and the whole proceeding, is it?
Well, it protects the student record.
The student's educational record, which this has been decided to be part of the student's, but it's the privacy, the Family Privacy Act relating to that student.
But if I gave you, Your Honor, a copy of the record of the complaint against Jerry Draper, and it shows that my associate, Ben Connolly, was one of the witnesses, and we don't redact her name. You go directly to her and say, what's this all about? And you find out it's about Jerry Draper, and you're suddenly identified through looking at those records, and by tracing through the easily identifiable information, it has been used. So my rights have been violated under the FERPA protection and under the handbook protection,
Mr. Draper, you've argued this in your brief. I'd like to hear your strongest argument on the issue of, under the code of 32G, it's 2, where no funds may be available under any applicable program, which is a policy or practice of releasing or providing access to any person identifiable information. That there's been an argument made that if we would order the records to be given in a different form than they're given, that ultimately would become a policy of the university. I'm having trouble understanding that. Can you help me with that?
First off, I read the statute. I came to the same conclusion I think Your Honor is struggling with, because it says, well, this isn't really a pattern of practice or policy because it's ordered by the court. This is our dilemma. If we're ordered in this case to do what they want, and give them the records that they want, any other time we get a request, we've got to do the same thing. Every other public university in the state suddenly has to do the same thing. You have an amicus brief from all 21 of them showing that over $700 million of the funding is in jeopardy. Now, we can't say that we were ordered by the Ohio Supreme Court on one case, and it's not our backers in policy. We're afraid that the Department of Education, looking at budgetary limitations they have to struggle with, and saying, well, Ohio has exception to FERPA that this court defines, that becomes the practice of policy, not only for my university, but for every public university in the state.
The relator cites, as you know, the relator cites in the reply brief, Section 20 U.S.C. 1232 TB2B as denying to counter that argument. What's your response to that? If a court orders the university to do something, that doesn't mean that a university has a policy to do it.
I think a fair reading of that statute is in a situation where there is a civil lawsuit going on or a criminal proceeding going on in our public court system, and the records of a particular student are needed as evidence for some reason in that particular proceeding. If a court orders that those records be turned over, that is not established a practice or policy that would violate FERPA. What we're dealing here with is the entire broad-scale issue of whether these records are protected by FERPA. And if this court finds they are not, then you have established for us the practice or policy that all these records are fair game. And where do we draw the line? How do we define education records differently than they've been set forth in FERPA? Do we suddenly now have to open up the financial records of parents? We have to open up the student transcripts. We have to open up other records that are contained in each student's file that under FERPA are defined as education records. Law enforcement unit records are separate and apart. We don't have any problem with that, except don't push UDB into that definition, because that's not where the definition lies. The public safety department is a police or law enforcement. Those records are not in front of you. The request to us was the disposition. The record showing the disposition of all proceedings before the DEA for a period of time. We have done everything recently to try to comply with that, even going beyond the technical requirements by preparing some summaries that we don't otherwise keep. And we try to provide some statistical analysis so they can look at the numbers. They have not been satisfied with anything we do. And you have the unredacted documents. You can look at what we've not given. And you can ask yourself whether what this information that we redacted about so-and-so's name, address, the date of this incident, is that really going to make this a safer campus? Is that going to fulfill the mission? Even if you think it does, that's not the test. The test is whether under the public records law we're required to turn over those records. It really doesn't matter what the purpose or the intent of the party requesting records has to use those records when they make a paper airplane out of it, when they do a study. But the issue is whether they are protected by FERPA in a manner that prohibits us from disclosing the contents.
Let me take you back. Your red lights. Let me take you back then to the first issue. The other question. Again, this has been thoroughly brief. I'd like to hear your strongest argument. Maybe it's the Louisiana case on the prohibition issue. It does seem that if you just apply the plain meaning of words, that a policy of the U.S. government that says, or Congress that says, that we're going to withdraw or withhold public funds from a university that has a policy to release these documents is different than an act of Congress saying to the university, you may not release certain academic or certain documents.
I recognize it does not use the word prohibit. But, Your Honor, this is no different than many other federal laws govern what goes on at the state level. Medicaid, if you don't comply with certain regulations, it's federal funding is cut off. Is that a prohibition? The effect is stronger than any language of prohibition could be, because the penalty, the loss of the money, is built into the process. It wouldn't be any stronger to say you are prohibited from giving these records, and if you do, we're going to take the money away from you. Instead, it says you shall not turn these records over, and we're going to take the money away from you. How can that be anything but a prohibition to a reasonable administrator trying to handle the funds and responsibilities of its campus?
Well, you could argue, I suppose you could make the argument, it probably sounds facetious in today's world, but that a university can't exist without federal aid. I know you're going to say how, but some universities apparently do, and obviously you're talking about a different situation.
But important to realize that the federal monies we're talking about, for the most part, are the financial grants they've given the students.
Right.
We're talking about money that goes to the people that go to school there. We're not building buildings with this money. We're not doing plans to make it a prettier campus. We're making funds available for students so that they can go and get their education.
If you wouldn't lose the money, would you turn the records over?
Sorry?
If you wouldn't lose the federal funding, would you turn the records over?
Well, if FERPA had some sort of prohibitory language in it that told us we shouldn't do it, we would have to again be in front of you and get back to Justice, Chief Justice Royer's question a minute ago, the policy or practice issue.
But here, there's
if we don't do it voluntarily after you order us to, if that's what your decision is.
But the federal.
We're going to litigate each one of these in the future.
I'm trying to find out whether or not you turned the records over if there wasn't a sanction. Wouldn't it fit? If the federal government said these records shall not be turned over, period, you wouldn't turn them over, would you?
No.
All right.
Okay. That's like a Social Security issue. You're prohibited from turning over the Social Security numbers and the scores.
It would seem your argument is because you're going to lose money is the reason that we're not turning these records over.
Well, it's because the question has been raised, how do you get to interpretation of this FERPA law being prohibited? And I think to determine whether it's prohibited, you have to look at the ramifications of a violation of its terms.
So if you prohibit it, there must be a sanction attached to it?
Or a complete absolute saying that you shall not do it. One of you could be served to. It doesn't have to be.
Well, your burden.
Just like other laws that say you shall not turn this over. The Social Security Act, as far as I know, doesn't impose a monetary fine on me if I give up a Social Security number that I shouldn't be turning over. But it says I shall not do that.
Thank you, Mr. Draper. Mr. Mezebov, you've used your time, but take a minute for rebuttal. Start.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, in response to Mrs. Coates' question, the burden of proof is squarely, legally, on the respondent to demonstrate the exception. They haven't even attempted to demonstrate that any of this information, they say is personally identifiable, could be traced to an individual.
And you and they say that, and I thought the sanctions were in there too. You know, you're really complaining a fair amount about not being able to tell that what the sanctions were. Is that the sanctions have been redacted?
Well,
but what's the deal with that?
Well, the simple answer to that rebuttal to Mr. Draper's remarks on page 13 of our brief. If you look at the sample, the piece of paper that we received. I defy anyone or to make any.
But I mean, we have many more examples than that.
This is typical.
They were in there.
We represent you that this is typical, and you will see that there is no divulging of what the sanction is in this instance. You cannot tell whether the university sanctioned this individual, if so, how, if so, whether it's in accordance with prior university policy or prior situations. There's absolutely nothing which would be informative in that regard.
Yes, that's a look. Has any other federal court ruled on this other than in Bauer versus Kincaid?
I believe the Shreveport case.
Well, there's the Georgia case, the black and white, the red and yellow cab company or something.
State but, state.
Yeah, but the,
but no court has ever ruled on Kincaid, the Public Records Act.
I understand, but Kincaid is the only one that has found that these are not educational records.
Other than the Georgia courts.
No, federal court, I said.
Okay. Counsel, let's get specific on the action. What about the defense?
We're not asking for the defense.
What about names of witnesses?
I'm not asking for the names of witnesses.
What else did they react that you not have disagreement with?
They give us absolutely nothing. It provides any information. It doesn't give us the name of the incident. It doesn't give us the location of an incident. It doesn't give us the precise nature of the incident.
The date and location you feel should not be redacted.
Correct.
Why should the date not be redacted?
Because I think it's important to put things in a time frame.
Well, what if they gave you a report that said for the period January 1st, 1995 through March 31st, 1995, we had this many incidents, this was the nature of them, this was the discipline that was ordered. Why do you need it? If you're interested
in... Well, the purpose on the respondent to show that this information, if we assume FERPA applies, it shows that it's easily traceable. And I don't believe that showing the date of the campus involving 15,000 students or the location of an incident renders that information easily traceable to an individual.
Well, if it's date and time, it's a crime, it's pretty easy to go to one of the crime agencies and match it up, is it not? As they say, if it's not a crime, then you're probably right.
Well, Your Honor, the answer to some of these questions does not have to be found in this court, because the CFR provides, if an educational agency or institution determines that it cannot comply with the Act, or this part due to a conflict with state and local law, which tells us that this is not preemptive, that FERPA contemplates these kinds of needs for public records, it shall notify the office within 45 days, giving a text and citation of the conflicting law. This is an affirmative obligation imposed by federal law on the state, which wishes to avail itself of federal funds. They complain about FERPA, yet they have to comply with FERPA. Jennifer Markevich gave the name of the compliance director to Dr. Ernest Powell at the university while she was trying cooperatively to work through all these matters. And Dr. Ernest Powell never took the bother to call Mr. Rooker, asked the lawyer to contact Mr. Rooker, or to contact the compliance office. So with Miami University now to come in and argue FERPA, 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 I think the result of that is that you want to read FERPA and you want to follow FERPA. You would have no concerns then of being found liable or losing all these funds because FERPA provides a safe haven in addition to a safe haven provided by a response.
I'm sorry, Justice Piper, I took the baton away from you. Was he finished with your question? Okay.
Can I make one further point?
Very quickly.
Your Honor, the question was posed as to whether or not serious acts of criminal misconduct would show up in incident reports and then you could follow it that way. Well, the reality is on this campus, as on many campuses, is that matters of serious criminal misconduct are sometimes diverted from the criminal justice system to an internal university system. Once the diversion is made, if we look at the Jennifer Majors situation, Jennifer Majors talked about the pressures that were applied to her, how she was in effect dissuaded from pursuing the matter one way and another. As a matter of fact, the university provided her with a waiver form, which they required that she sign to go left or go right. She can't go both, she was led to believe. But these matters are then diverted. Once they get into this system, they are shrouded. We will never know whether somebody assaulted individual, or committed some other offense, was punished properly by that university disciplinary board. And to say that's not information that the public has a right to know, I submit it is to hide our heads and ignore the reality.
Thank you, Mr. Mizabov.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.